Support for The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. After a dozen Democratic presidential candidates debate in Ohio, several make their way to New Hampshire. Department of Health and Human Services Commissioner Jeffrey Myers says he will not seek another term. And a shooting at a church in Pelham leaves three people injured and a small community shaken. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we'll talk about them in this hour. If you have questions or comments about the week's news, send them to us by email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page. Just search for us by searching for NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. And we're also broadcasting a live video of this radio show today, so you can watch that at our Facebook page. Again, search for NHPR Exchange. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dean Spiliotis, Pacific Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Matt Sartwell, Managing Editor of the New Hampshire Union Leader, and political reporter Paul Steinhauser. Thank you all for being here today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Peter.
Hey, Peter.
So, big news of the week, the debate. We've heard a lot about it, but I want to hear from you gentlemen on your big takeaways on this. Some of these candidates are coming to New Hampshire. We're going to talk about those. But first, let's hear from you first, Matt. What's your big takeaway from Tuesday's Democratic debate?
Well, I think that the big takeaway for me was that Elizabeth Warren looked like the front runner in the debate. I mean, she certainly was taken on by the other candidates as the front runner, and also that the format, the number of people in that debate made it hard for the lesser polling candidates to really break out this time around. I mean, you had the Midwestern nice of Klobuchar and Buttigieg kind of making a play there. That was probably the people who did the most out of the debate as far as they're concerned. But, I mean, Elizabeth Warren looks like she's the horse to beat right now.
Mm-hmm. Paul?
Yeah, so much has happened in the month since we had the previous debate, from impeachment, which obviously that's where the debate started. But of course, so much else. The race has really changed. And as Matt just said, yes, it's clear. There are two front runners in this race right now. If you look at the polls, it's Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren. But the target was off Joe Biden's back, and it was clearly on Warren's back. She performed pretty well. After a slow start, she really did defend her policies quite well. Agreed, Buttigieg and Klobuchar, if any of the lower-tier candidates, or the middle-tier, let's call them middle-tier candidates, had a big night, it was them. For some others, there was trouble. Beto O'Rourke, when it came to his top issue, which is gun control, he had got into what seemed to be a personal scrap with Buttigieg, and I don't think he came out that well. Will it change anything? Probably not. That's the big difference this time around from the last two cycles, where the debates really changed the polls dramatically, especially in the 12 cycle. This time around, other than Kamala Harris's takedown of Biden back in June, the polls have not really changed from these debates, and I don't think it's going to change much from this debate.
Let me ask you a little bit more about Elizabeth Warren. You said that she explained her policy positions pretty well. She did get a lot of criticism for not coming out and saying whether or not taxes would go up on the middle class with respect to Medicare for all. But, Paul, what policy positions do you think she spelled out quite well?
Wealth tax on the wealthy is something that she defended quite well. That came under attack from a bunch of the other candidates. You're right, though. The big one, the one that's going to stick out, and this is not going to go away, is she can't explain whether middle-class taxes will go up or not. And it was quite awkward because just moments earlier in the debate, Bernie Sanders, as he has in the past, acknowledged that, yes, those taxes will go up, but obviously that the premiums will go away and the middle-class Americans won't pay as much. This is going to be an issue for Warren. It's not going away. It's only going to intensify as we go further into the debates.
I want to get to Dean, but Matt, you wanted to jump in.
Just to jump on that, Warren did stay true to her message, though. She's not going to be sucked into a soundbite, and which is why I personally think that she didn't mention about getting taxes.
She doesn't want Trump in a general election to say, look, she admitted she's going to raise taxes on the middle class.
Exactly. And as we all know, plans are plans, but it's really Congress who puts it together, right?
Mm-hmm. So, Dean, what do you think?
Yeah, I continue to believe that 12
candidates on the stage is just too many. You had moments or periods in that debate. I think at one point Julian Castro went almost 45 minutes without actually getting to speak at all. And, you know, the max candidates got maybe 15 minutes total when you add up all the minutes on stage. You know, I think the couple of big takeaways from this debate, you know, we saw, as Paul mentioned, Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg, the consensus was that they had the strongest nights, in particular defining themselves as moderates vis-a-vis Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. I think they see a potential opportunity if Joe Biden continues to slide in the polls a little bit. They may pick up his support. You know, Biden had a good night for him. He still continues to be a little uneven. A friend of mine mentioned to me that whenever she watches him, she likes him, but she finds herself holding her breath while he goes through his answers because he does have a tendency to go down these tangents and cul-de-sacs. But he had a good night. For him, I think he had a good night overall. You know, my belief is that if these debates have any impact on candidacies, we should see some movement for Buttigieg and Klobuchar. Klobuchar raised over $1 million, I think, in the next 24 hours off of her performance. You know, my belief traditionally has been that these debates have kind of a transitory, a transient effect. You get a little bit of a bump, and then things kind of settle back down. If they do matter, then we should see some movement for Klobuchar and Buttigieg. I agree with what Paul said about Beto O'Rourke. He's kind of become a one-issue candidate, a single-issue candidate on guns. Some people think that's a worthwhile issue to be single-issue on, but historically, single-issue candidates don't fare well in these kind of nomination contests. Clearly, the other candidates view Elizabeth Warren as a front-runner now. You saw that by the ferocity of the attacks. This issue with funding her Medicare for all and, you know, costs go down overall, but she won't say that there's going to be a tax increase. I understand why she's doing that tactically, but it's going to keep dogging her until she comes up with a different answer.
Paul.
Yeah, and Buttigieg as well raised $1.1 million, the same that Klobuchar did in those first 24 hours. So in the absence of polls, you know, fundraising is another good metric that we use.
Yep.
So, yes, they had good nights, and it showed immediately. You know, Dean talked about that was a record-setting field of 12 candidates. We've never had 12 candidates on the same stage at the same time in a presidential primary.
Do you agree, Paul? Too big? Too big a field?
Yeah, the DNC could have gone the other way. 6-6, they decided not to. They could have done it over two nights. Now, we probably won't have this issue, though, in the next debate, which is going to be on November 20th. It looks like in Atlanta, Georgia. That'll be on NBC because as of now, only eight have qualified. They've raised the thresholds. Only eight have qualified, maybe one or two more. The deadline will be a week before the debate, I think, like the 11th or the 12th or 13th.
So they've got time.
They've got time.
It could be equally big. Maybe.
I wouldn't count on it just because the thresholds are higher now. Klobuchar hasn't even qualified yet. She needs some extra polls. So it'll be a smaller field.
Yeah, I mean, the other challenge here is that there's so much going on in the national political narrative dealing with impeachment and Ukraine and now with Turkey and the Kurds, that some people believe that it's actually kind of freezing the race largely in place, that you have these brief moments around these debates where it kind of bubbles up into the national consciousness, and then we go back to focusing on President Trump and everything going on in Washington, and there's just not a lot of room in kind of the prevailing political narrative to get the kind of coverage you might want. So, you know, I've said now for a while, it feels like the national narrative and debate is kind of driving what's happening in the caucuses and the primaries rather than the reverse. It's not New Hampshire and Iowa driving everything else. It's what's going on nationally kind of driving what's happening on the ground. And it kind of, you have these debates where everybody focuses for a few days and then they go back to focusing on what's going on in Washington. And I think that's a little problematic for candidates who want to try to get a little bit more traction. A lot of these candidates are still down in low single digits. I mean, we're really at this point talking about, you know, Warren and Biden and Sanders and Buttigieg. Kamala Harris has dropped back a bit. Amy Klobuchar and Cory Booker, even though they had good nights, they're still in low to medium single digits. So the race has been, for the most part, with the exception of Elizabeth Warren's momentum, which is a big story, it's been largely static for the most part.
Matt Sartwell.
And Bernie Sanders, you know, his supporters have to be confident after the debate because after his heart attack, I mean, he stood up there, he held his own, he was on message, and then what, a couple days later, he gets to pick up a big endorsement from AOC. I mean, that's
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
That actually broke as the debate. I was in the spin room and press file at the debate. That was breaking, and I confirmed it for Fox News after the Washington Post first reported. That was happening real time during the debate, and it was a big issue in the spin room as the candidates came in afterward. That helps Bernie Sanders big time, because right now he's battling for progressive voters against who? Elizabeth Warren, right? And she's moving further ahead of him. So to have not just AOC, but a couple of the other very progressive freshman Democrats on his side, endorsements don't matter that much, but it was a nice little boost for him.
Well, Paul, let's talk a little bit about some of the candidates that have been here in New Hampshire this week, notably Amy Klobuchar. Mm-hmm. She was in Concord yesterday. She's also been campaigning in Keene. She's apparently going to hit all 10 counties. That's her plan.
She did.
She did.
And she did it in record time. Beto O'Rourke did the same thing when he first came here in March, his first trip after he jumped in. Remember when he was on that meteoric rise that didn't last very long. She hit all 10 counties in, guys, I think it was like 34 hours. And she's now gone. So, yes.
Did she stop in any of the counties? I mean, she did. But
I saw her two places, Harvey's Bakery in Dover, which is a must stop if you're running for the White House in either party. And then at Revelstoke, which has become a big stop
Revelstoke
for Democrats.
In Concord. Well, let's hear a little bit from Amy Klobuchar as she campaigned here in New Hampshire.
I'm very optimistic we're going to make it. We already have one poll in, and we've made all the other criteria the day that they announced it. We have more than enough donors. We just raised $1.2 million in 24 hours after this debate, then I'm just going to keep getting out there. And New Hampshire is really important for me. Very important that my supporters answer calls about polls, yes. I feel that we're going to make it. And I'm going to be in for the end anyway. We have a number of offices here in this state. We've got a great state director, former legislator in Scott Merrick, and we put together a big operation. But I'm very hopeful that I'll make that stage.
Amy Klobuchar sounding optimistic, saying she's in it to the end.
Yeah, regardless of whether she makes the next debate or not. But they always say that. But yeah, she's got momentum now. She had at Revelstoke, the place was jam-packed. And it wasn't during the breakfast hour, right, when you'd expect it to be jam-packed.
Nor was it during good weather, right?
No.
It was terrible weather and people still came out.
She kept calling it a Northeaster, which I think is okay, technically okay. But, we know it as a Nor'easter. She was giddy that it was her first Northeaster. She was very excited about that.
Where'd she put the comma? Where'd she put the apostrophe?
Listen, she's got some momentum now. And she also admitted elsewhere in that interview that this is a critical time for her. And it is. This is now when she needs to raise a boatload of cash and hopefully start moving up in the polls. Because as Dean said, this is her moment. She had a great debate. Now she's got to move forward.
All right. Well, I wanted to ask you, Matt, because the union leader was the co-presenter of a candidate forum at which Senator Michael Bennett spoke. Tell us a little bit about that event. How did that go with Michael Bennett? What was the takeaway there?
Well, it was at Great Bay Community College, and we're partnered. The union leader is partnered up with Goldman Sachs and their 10,000 businesses, a small businesses initiative, and he came in. It was a very good afternoon out, from all reports. I wasn't at it myself, and Bennett fielded all questions. He did very well, but I think when you step away from it. I mean, he still has the same problem that Dean kind of flicked at. He's not polling very high, and he's not making any debates. And he's out there as, a centrist. You've seen, and I'm seeing you guys have all seen the emails coming through. Bennett is also taking his shots at Warren and in his press literature. But he's just not – he's like one of those candidates that just can't get the traction that he needs.
Well, Bennett is dealing with – this is the proverbial tree falling in the forest issue where – nobody's around to see it. If you're not in those national debates now, given what I just said about kind of how dominated the political narrative is by all the stuff with President Trump and Washington, et cetera, to not be on that debate stage, you're not part of the conversation.
Not anymore, at least. He was in June, right?
He was initially, I think he was in at least one or two, but he's somebody who's in a similar ideological space with Amy Klobuchar and maybe even Pete Buttigieg, kind of an alternative to a Joe Biden style of candidate. So it's just very difficult at this point. If you're not part of the national discussion, which he can't be if he's not on those stages, given that that's really the only time it percolates up to the national consciousness, it's just very hard to do anything. But, he continues to do it, but I don't really know what his game plan could be going forward.
Paul?
That was Bennett's second trip here to New Hampshire in 2 weeks. I had a chance to chat with him on the first trip. And we also had Montana Governor Steve Bullock. Similar situation, you know, hasn't made the debate stages now in the autumn.
He's a bit more high visibility, though, than Bennett. Bennett's a little more under.
Why would you say that? I mean, I've seen them both kind of equally.
Well, Bullock's been more out on the cable news channels. His social media operation and his emailing operation, his contact operation is a bit stronger and a bit broader. But he still faces the same.
He's got the same
overall challenge. If you're not on that stage, given how crowded the political discourse is right now, if you're not on that stage, you know, people aren't going to really know about you.
And here's what they're saying, both of them, because I had a chance to talk with both of them, and they're saying the same thing. They're downplaying the significance of the debates, which that's fine. But at the end of the day, they're still not making it. They're not allowing 10 to 15 million people to watch them. And they're saying they're concentrating on retail politics in the early voting states. So they're trying, again, the Jimmy Carter model, which worked so well, 45 years ago. Yeah. But
in a different time technologically.
Exactly.
Different time in terms of mass communication.
Bingo.
Yeah, well, let's talk. Well, I should mention Michael Bennett, senator from Colorado. Another senator worth talking about is Cory Booker, senator from New Jersey. He made a point of remaining positive, both on the debate stage and on the campaign trail more generally. He's going to be in New Hampshire on Sunday. He's going to be at Dartmouth College, going to appear at Hopkins Center for the Arts. Paul Steinhauser, what do you make of Cory Booker's performance on Tuesday?
He had a good performance, as he has in these debates. He just, there's not a viral moment for him. But no, yes, he preaches the politics of love. He stays positive. Other than really criticizing Joe Biden earlier this summer, he stayed very positive against most of the candidates. He was backing Biden during the debate, obviously, over the Ukrainian controversy, which has led to the impeachment inquiry by the House Democrats. He's done everything right. He's got a big staff here, a strong staff in New Hampshire. He's up here a lot. He's very, very good at retail politics. He's probably the best orator in the party. But again, in this cycle, it's hard for him to break through. As you mentioned, he's here on Sunday. He'll also be here on Monday as well in Concord doing an event with Annie Custer on opioids.
He's been very active here in New Hampshire as much as any other candidate. The problem he faces is that I keep getting emails from people who say he would be a great vice presidential candidate. And when people start pigeonholing you as, oh, he'd be a terrific VP candidate, it's very hard for people to kind of shift their thinking for you to be at the top of the ticket. And he's had consistently good debate performances. His message in the last debate was the party needs to stay focused on Trump and not get distracted with a lot of the intramural fighting over some of the policy differences. But for whatever reason, he has just kind of not broken through as, you know, one of the top couple of potential candidates for the nomination. But as I said, I get probably a few emails a week of people saying, hey, he'd be a great VP candidate. And that just seems to be how people are thinking of him.
Who's sending you these emails?
Just you would love to see my inbox. All kinds of people, you know, sort of people who are out there in the world who send me their opinions all the time. And I've multiple emails. Hey, he'd be a great VP candidate.
We like listener opinions, too, yes. By the way. Exchange@nhpr.org. If you've got one, send them our way. Matt Sartwell.
Yeah, I agree with what Dean and Paul are saying. I think his message of civility really hits his core block of voter or people who are back him. But listen, if you're at a pie eating contest, do you want to be the guy handing out napkins? I mean, I don't think people are really looking for someone who's got some belly fire. Not saying he doesn't, because he does, but it just doesn't come off that way sometimes in the debates.
And does he risk in some way sort of alienating some of his fellow candidates by almost appearing to lecture them by saying, hey, let's all be nice here?
Well, I think by not acknowledging him, they may make their point. Right. That's what they've done to Kamala Harris. I mean, they've basically said, you know what? We're not going to get a knife fight with Kamala Harris. It's not going to end well like it didn't end well for Biden. Right. On the debate stage. So we're just going to let her do her thing and we're just going to move on with our message.
I see. Paul, I wanted to ask you about a line in one of your stories for the Concord Monitor this week. You were reporting on polls, and there's one poll that came out just before the debate that said it was a Boston Herald Franklin Pierce University survey. It indicated that if Michelle Obama entered the race, and oh my God, another candidate, no matter who it is. But anyway, if Michelle Obama entered the race, she would capture the front runner spot. Tell us more about that, please.
And this is the story that everybody cared about, even though it's not based in reality, right? There's no way Michelle Obama.
She said so. She said nope.
Numerous times. It's clear she will not be running for president in 2020. But yeah, the poll asked the question, why? Because they wanted to make a headline, and they did. It got a lot of pickup. I wrote about it for the Monitor as well as Fox News, and it got a lot of clicks. Yeah, it indicated if she jumped into the race, she would be at 26% here in New Hampshire among likely Democratic primary voters, with Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren at 20%, Bernie Sanders at 15%, everybody else further down. So yes, she would instantly become the front runner, and that instantly made headlines, but it's not going to happen.
Yeah, the interesting thing with that is, you know, she's beloved in the Democratic Party. Nationally, she's always at the top of most respected women polls, most respected public figure polls. But you think back about Hillary Clinton. When Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, mm-hmm. she had incredibly high approval, I think up in the 60 or 70% range approval as Secretary of State. Once you switch and become a candidate for elected office, things change a little bit. It gets a little more uneven. The knives come out, so to speak. And so, I think she would be, as Paul said, it's not going to happen, but she would be tremendously popular. But I think her people's perspective on her would change a little bit, much in the same way it happened to Hillary Clinton when she went from this kind of governmental official to an elected, a potentially elected politician.
Well, listeners who are interested, we're going to be posting stories to links to the stories that we've been discussing here. So check NHPR.org if you're interested in reading more on Paul's story that mentions Michelle Obama in this poll. I want to shift away from presidential candidates for just a moment. And ask you, Matt Sartwell, about Corey Lewandowski, former Trump campaign manager. Corey Lewandowski says he's still considering whether or not to run for Senate and challenge Senator Jean Shaheen. So what's he waiting on, Matt?
Oh, will he or won't he? Will he or won't he? I mean, I'm just on pins and needles. I mean,
it would make the race a little more interesting, would it not? It would be four candidates on the Republican side.
Yeah, it would be. It would definitely be. And listen, he said all along that he's like, It's Trump presidency first, right? There's a little bit of that where he's saying, like, what can I do to help get Trump reelected? On the other side of that, he was waiting for the money to come in. He said if no one could raise $2 million. Now, I think there's a little bit of that, that it was set really high. That's what he said. And, of course, Corky Messner, General Don Bolduc, and Bill O'Brien, none of them came close to that, to $2 million. So I guess we'll see over the next week or so. I don't know. Who knows?
Over the next week or so, maybe.
Who knows exactly?
He hasn't set a deadline for I will make a decision by this particular date.
And I had conversations early on with Kevin Landergan, our State House Bureau Chief, and we were talking about it. And it's like, was there a little bit about he wanted the other the Republican primary candidates to kind of clear out, give him a clear shot at it? I mean, I don't know. What does Jean Shaheen want? That's my other question. Like, who would she rather go up against? Does she want to be on a debate stage with General Don Bolduc? Or would she rather be? I mean, she's already using Corey Lewandowski as her main campaign, campaign
fundraising foil.
Fundraising foil, no doubt.
Is that working?
She just had a record-breaking third quarter, $2.3 million, and she has $4.3 million mm-hmm. cash on hand. She's raising big money. She continues to be, in general, a popular senator. Her approval rating in the state is in the low to mid 50s typically. She would be a formidable candidate for Lewandowski. Lewandowski could bring in a lot of outside money. We don't know exactly how much. There'd be a lot more synergy between him and the Trump campaign, given, he was president. He really was the campaign manager for President Trump, who rose to national prominence until he was replaced by Paul Manafort. It would be a really interesting race. The others, Messner, $219,000 raised, loaned $1 million to himself, and General Bolduc, $239,000. So, $2.3 million versus $250,000 is a big difference. And that's you see it less so with U.S. Senate races because they're high profile, but you do see kind of a lopsided cash advantage in terms of the incumbent typically.
Paul Steinhauser.
Yeah, we had a chance, myself and a bunch of other reporters, to talk with Lewandowski about a week ago when he headlined a big Trump rally in the streets of Manchester. Listen, he was pretty clear that he wasn't in a rush anymore to make that decision, and he doesn't have to be. I think he may want to see how impeachment plays out. And if the president survives, if he's impeached by the House and then survives in the Senate, Lewandowski's argument is that will embolden and strengthen support for Trump among Republicans in this state, which is a good thing for him. He's got the luxury of waiting because he could even jump in January or February, maybe even March, and still raise a boatload of money right off the bat. So I'd be surprised if he makes a decision this soon. He's got the luxury like nobody else in the Republican side.
He said something about maybe deciding over the weekend, but we'll see.
He talked about that on a radio show in Virginia that he goes on quite often, a conservative radio show. We'll see. With Corey Lewandowski, it's always unpredictable.
Okay. Well, Paul Steinhauser, thank you very much for being here on the program today. We really appreciate your insights.
Always great to join you guys. And besides the Booker, we also have Elizabeth Warren and Buttigieg in the state later next week.
So you'll be covering that next week?
You got it.
Anything else we should look for? Paul Steinhauser bylines?
Stay tuned.
Okay, great.
Everywhere.
Paul Steinhauser, a New Hampshire-based political reporter who writes for Fox News, The Concord Monitor, Seacoast Online. Find him on Twitter. He's tweeting all the time. If you want to know what's going on in the state in real time, follow him on Twitter. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. Just a reminder, too, that the last day for voters who are registered to change their party affiliation before the 2020 presidential primary, October 25th, coming up. So please check with your local city or town clerk or supervisors for place of meeting. This is The Exchange, the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We love your questions or comments. Email them to us now, exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
On Monday on The Exchange, we'll be learning about some of New Hampshire's underappreciated creatures, porcupines, opossums, fishers. And not as charismatic as moose or bear, but they do play an important role in our ecosystem and have had their own recent struggles. We'll learn about them on Monday on The Exchange. That's live at 9. But right now, we're taking a fresh look at the events of the past week on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. In the studio with me, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, managing editor of the New Hampshire Union Leader, Matt Sartwell, and joining us now for this part of the program, NHPR's Jason Moon. Jason, welcome.
Good
Thanks
morning.
For being here. So, Jason, let's start by talking about DCYF a little bit, because you've been reporting on the Department for Children, Youth, and Families, and you reported this week that reports of child abuse and neglect reached a record high in New Hampshire during the last fiscal year. Tell us a little bit about this. How bad is that problem?
Well, it just continues a trend that we've seen over the last at least 5 years. So we reached in the fiscal year, this last fiscal year, more than 30,000 calls to DCYF of reports of maltreatment, child neglect, child abuse. That's up from, if you look at 2015, it was 24,000. So, you know, 5,000 more calls than 4 years ago. It continues that trend. You know, DCYF has investigated more than 12,000 of those calls this past year. They actually went out and did investigations, talked to people, that sort of thing.
And is that better than what they did previously? Are they investigating more as well?
They are investigating more as well, okay. Yeah. And, you know, it's hard to know exactly what's driving those numbers. It could be a lot of things. I mean, certainly people point to the opioid crisis as a big part of that. It could also just be greater awareness of the department itself and what they do. They have been in the news a lot over the last several years, so that sort of could be sort of playing into itself almost. The people hear about DCYF's troubles, and then they are aware of the agency and then think are more likely to report things. But it also highlights how the agency continues to be overwhelmed. For the past several years, the department has been sort of, embattled. There's been lawsuits against it for allegations of sort of dereliction of duty on the side of the department. And there's been a lot of work to try to bring down the caseload numbers for staff workers at DCYF. But it's hard for them to do that when the number of calls coming in are continuing to increase. So even as they've been hiring new folks, the caseload average has remained pretty flat over the last couple of years.
We've talked about that caseload on this program before. Yes. With respect to, I believe it was months ago, the Office of the Child Advocate saying listen, state of New Hampshire, we need to hire more of these people so that the caseload number can go down and that more of these cases, more than the 12,000 that were investigated, for example, can be investigated.
Yeah, and that the caseload average has been an oft-cited number. There's been a lot of focus on that because at the height of DCYF's sort of troubles or of their of being overburdened, there was a caseload per caseworker of more than 90 cases. The nationally recommended average is 12. Mm. That number now sits at around 45. So certainly the department has seen an improvement. So caseworkers are now juggling 45 on average cases of reports of child abuse, but that's still, you know, 3 to 4 times above what is nationally recommended. So that's kind of the overall thrust of this new batch of data from DCYF is that you can see there's some improvements like that where things are moving in the right direction, but it really underscores, you know, how far they have to go. And on that point about hiring new staff, that's been another area of concern is can they hire them fast enough? And so you may remember last year there was Senate Bill 6, which was passed by the legislature. It was a big shot in the arm for DCYF to hire a bunch of new workers. That was slated to allow them to hire 57 new people over the next 2 years. According to the Office of Child Advocate, right now only 18 of them have been hired so far. And so that will be a struggle as well continuing into the future. You know, can they attract candidates? Can they hire them fast enough to sort of keep up with the surging number of calls they're getting on the other end?
And Jason, how have state leaders responded to this report, if at all?
Well, we heard, you know, we got a statement and a sort of overview from DCYF, from Director Ribsum, you know, and one of the things they pointed to, which is a, you know, could be construed as a bright spot in the report, is that more children are exiting the services and out of home placement programs, which is in general a good sign if you have fewer children that have to be taken out of their homes. However, you know, there is some question about that number. I mean, the Office of Child Advocate, for instance, you know, raised the question that, well, that number is good on its face, but the numbers that aren't included in this new report are why are those children leaving the out-of-home placement program? Is it just that they're aging out and maybe they don't have a transition plan? And if that's the case for many of them, then it may not be such a bright spot. So it's hard to know without getting more detailed information from the department. But in general, I think what the department would say and state officials would say is, you know, there's still a lot of work ahead, but things are starting to move in the right direction.
Well, Matt Sartwell, you wanted to weigh in.
I mean, that just makes a lot of sense to me that, listen, those caseworkers, that is an incredibly difficult, challenging job. And as you know, we have our own employment crisis in the state, right? So to find qualified people, I mean, you just can't walk off the street and do that job. You need a lot of training, and it's very complicated. I mean, you're going into these very volatile situations. And as Jason pointed out, this opioid epidemic has not gone away. And it's still, and we'll be talking about other tangential aspects of it later. I mean, that's part of the problem. I mean, look at all the people, all the young childs who have been overdosed in the last year. It's a terrible tragedy. I think this is a huge battleship that they're taking the right steps to try to move, but it's going to be hard and it's going to be a lot of work.
Yeah, that's a fair point. And I was thinking as you were talking about, you know, we've been talking about the opioid crisis on the roundup for like 5 years, and the conversations we were having 5 years ago about how the state was dealing with it versus how they're dealing with it now are different. And I think the same thing is happening there. People have recognized this a problem with DCYF. We now have the child advocate. I do think they are trying to fill more of these positions for caseworkers, but it does take time, and there are these kind of competing forces working on it. But I think they're going to continue to move, hopefully, in the right direction.
And when you look at these kind of numbers, you're like, well, we got to do this now, right? It's hard to really get your head around, well, we'll just take our time, right? It's hard when you see numbers like this. It's very dramatic, and it's heartbreaking. And so you want to have this knee-jerk reaction, well, we got to do something now, now, now. But that's not how this – I don't feel that that's how this really works.
Mm-hmm. Talking about challenging jobs, too, the commissioner of the Department of Health and Human Services, huge part of state government.
Yeah.
Commissioner of Department of Health and Human Services, Jeffrey Myers, announced this week, or it became public this week, that he is not going to seek another 4-year term. Jason, was this surprising to you?
You know, it It was a little bit. I mean, I think Myers had been become invested in many of the department's biggest challenges over the last several years, and there are many challenges that the department faces. We just talked about one with DCYF. You know, there's the issues of caseworkers and caseloads, and there's also, you know, pending litigation against the department for actions of DCYF in the past. But that's just one of many issues. There's also what's going to happen with Medicaid expansion in the state, the work requirement that was rolled out that is now rolled back because of another lawsuit that's also pending before the department. There is, you know, everything they're doing with relation to the opioid crisis, the doorway, the hub system. It is a sprawling and multifaceted job, and you will not see me applying for it.
Well, what kind of person might Governor Sununu be looking to appoint? I imagine it. I mean, we heard from Josh Rogers this week that it is going to involve some level of political savvy. What kind of candidate would be looking for this kind of job?
That's a great question, and I'll be really curious to see what, you know, what kind of applications they get, who will be wanting to step up to this role. You know, my sense is that it's more likely than not to be someone who's already in state government, in the department itself, rather than someone from out of state. But, you know, we could be surprised again. We'll see.
You know, the department has 40% of the state budget, and it employs over 3,000 employees. I mean, this is a huge organization, and they're tasked with so many different things. And I thought it was encouraging. It was nice to see that not only did Governor Sununu, you know, praise Myers as he announces that he was leaving, but also like Donna Soucy, she also praised him. So it was, but you know, he got some kudos for doing the best he could under the end of these trying times, and that's nice to see.
And from both parties too. Yeah, he was appointed exactly. by Democrat Maggie Hassan, and he right. seemed to not butt heads at all with Governor right. Sununu. As far as I can tell.
And that is one of the key challenges. A lot of the policy areas that you guys have mentioned are policy areas that have been quite quite contentious between Republicans and Democrats in the state legislature. So it's really a kind of a double whammy. You have to be able to navigate the political waters between the two parties on a lot of these issues. And as we were just saying, it's a very, by New Hampshire standards, it's a big bureaucracy, and it is often at the center of a lot of the budget debate and budget challenges about spending. And so it's a significant task. It's going to take somebody, you know, whether they're out of state or not, it's going to take somebody who's comfortable with the sort of bureaucratic politics that go along with it.
Now, the good thing about that is that Myers has probably put him in a really good spot, right? Hub and spoke has started, right? There's a number of, you know, they're dealing with, as you said, all these issues with the child services. So they're on the right path. So those are some of the things that the next person who comes to the job, he has a little bit of a headway. He doesn't have to make this from spun cloth, you know?
Mm-hmm. Jason, there's one more story I want to ask you about before you have to run. And that's that a rare mosquito-borne virus is becoming slightly less rare. Another case emerging in New Hampshire. It's called the Jamestown Canyon virus. What is this virus, Jason?
Yeah, as if there weren't enough things to worry about. Right. So we saw West Nile pop up again, I think about a month ago or so.
And Tripoli is popping up here and there.
And here's another one to worry about. You know, basically, we're just going to be seeing these things, you know, more and more often as time goes on. And but all the same precautions, you know, hold, you know, standing water, that sort of thing, remove it, bug spray. And basically until we get two hard frosts, that we, you know, the concern will be there. So until it if you need a reason to look forward to winter, there it is. Hard frosts, the mosquitoes are gone. You don't have to worry about all these new viruses.
I take offense to that. If you live in New Hampshire, you have to love winter. What are you doing here if you don't love winter?
I don't know, man. I have mixed feelings about winter myself. But you know, Jason points out a nice perk is that, you know, after the first two statewide frosts, not so much a concern about both mosquitoes and ticks, right?
That's right, yeah.
And yellow jackets. A number of my neighbors have been stung by these in-ground yellow jacket nests that are often happen in the fall, and then the frost also kills it off.
Bring on the snow.
# New Hampshire problems. Yeah. Okay, well, this is the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Jason Moon has joined us for this part of the program. We have to let you go. NHPR's Jason Moon, thank you very much. Really appreciate it. We have more to talk about this hour, but here are some of the stories that we've been following from the NHPR newsroom this week. The Joint Legislative Committee on Administrative Rules voted yesterday to officially reject a proposal from the State Board of Education that would have required high schools to grant students credit for extracurriculars. The program, called Learn Everywhere, faced fierce opposition from Democrats and many proponents of public education. but its supporters say it would have expanded opportunities, especially for disadvantaged students. A version of Learn Everywhere may still go into effect. The House and Senate can review the proposal and modify it, and if approved, it could be implemented next year. Also, the state is currently setting up a new office in Concord to recruit and retain younger workers through New Hampshire's outdoor industry. Taylor Caswell, the commissioner of the Department of Business and Economic Affairs, says a younger workforce is key to growing the economy. A big story in the news this week that I want to talk to you, Matt, about, because the union leader's been on top of this, is that a man walked into a church during a wedding in Pelham with a gun and shot Bishop Stanley Choate, the bride, and then he hit the groom on the head with the gun. That man is allegedly 37-year-old Dale Holloway, who now faces multiple charges. Matt, what do we know so far about this shooting?
Well, to really get your head around it, and it's pretty complicated. You have to go back to October 1st, and that's when a minister at New England Pentecostal Church, Louis Garcia, was killed in the home of Mark Castiglione, and that's the guy who was pistol whipped at the altar on Saturday, right? So he, Louis Garcia, was allegedly killed by Mark's son, Brandon Castiglione, mm-hmm. right? So then on Saturday, the wedding of Mark and Claire McCullen, I think I've got that name, Claire McCullen, was set to go. And then afterwards was the memorial service for Louis Garcia. I mean, it's a terrible tragedy, but that just, it seemed like there was going to be a problem. It seems like now from, 10,000 feet, there seems like there was going to be a problem there with those two things lined up, and sure enough, one happened.
So, and the police are definitely exploring the revenge killing, quote unquote, aspect of this. It's still an allegation, but I just want to summarize, Matt, really quickly, because it is kind of a tangled web. So let's, if I were the alleged killer, I would say, okay, you killed my stepdad, so I will attempt to kill your dad. That's kind of how it worked.
Yeah, exactly.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. And law enforcement probably rightly hasn't, they're locking this up, but that's the kind of the amateur reading of it.
Okay, and it's unfolded in the courts a little bit this week. So what's the bottom line for all the twists and turns we've seen since
Saturday? Well, I think it should be noted that Dale Holloway has a couple of convictions for assault in Massachusetts. He waived arraignment. That's pretty standard. And then he'll be back in court next week.
Okay. Why did this have so much traction as a news story? I mean, this made pretty big headlines and caught a lot of traction nationwide.
Well, I mean, it's the calculus, right? It's a school. It starts off as a report of a school shooting.
I'm sorry,
a church shooting.
Yes, which still a big deal, very dramatic because it's a church shooting.
Exactly.
We saw one in Texas. It was very bad.
Yeah, and then I mean, someone walking in a church and shooting, allegedly shooting a minister and pistol whipping people. I mean, that's out of the ordinary.
Yeah, certainly. So this is a story that is unfolding still in the courts now, especially. So we'll have to continue to follow it. We'll move on from that from now, because one more thing I want to ask you about, Matt, before the break, and this is another thing that the Manchester union leader or the New Hampshire union leader has been following, which is that the union leader reported the Manchester City Welfare Department expects to overspend on its housing budget this year, a problem related to homelessness. Well, what's the deal there, Matt?
Well, this has been in the news a lot lately, and a little bit with Jeff Meyer's agency that we just talked about. Manchester has a really persistent homeless problem, and they're not alone, of course. I mean, we know there's a homeless problem wherever there's opioids. There's a homeless problem too. Maybe that's a little too general, but you get my point. Mayor Joyce Craig and the aldermen, they just passed an initiative. I think it was a month and a half ago, maybe 2 months ago, where they're trying to get more people off the streets in shelters, and they're trying to combat this persistent homelessness. But it's really hard. I mean, there's only so much illegally they can do, as the ACLU will tell you, to move people off the streets of Manchester. And as far as the budget goes, it pointed out in our story that that's only kind of the tip of the iceberg. A lot of these people, a lot of the homeless people, they don't want to use the shelters. I mean, to be kind of bald-faced about it, I mean, they're either they feel they're independent living on the the street, or they've got some sort of addiction problem they don't want to give up to go into shelters.
The shelters are dry shelters, so the condition upon staying there is that you cannot use any drugs or alcohol.
I want to speak in general because there's a lot of different kinds, but yeah, sure. That's my understanding.
Understood. Okay.
Dean Scalia. Yeah, that in particular has been a long-term challenge. There are mental health issues where people prefer to be on their own and have difficulty in these kinds of structured shelters. We're talking, I think it's a $196,000 annual budget. They've already spent $80,000, most of it on missed rental payments and other kinds of housing costs. Mm-hmm. So
preventing people from becoming homeless,
yeah,
right?
Basically, yeah, helping them stay put or getting them into some sort of a housing situation. But it's a challenging problem, and not just here, but all around the country. A number of cities deal with it on a regular basis, and it really does strain city finances, and you end up having to look for either federal dollars or state dollars or something to help. And Manchester, it's been a particular issue. Manchester has kind of been the focal point for it.
Unfortunately, I feel like winter, as we just said, is right around the corner, and that's when we're going to really see some really tough decisions being made.
Matt Sartwell and reporting on the union leader are linked to at nhpr.org. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. More to talk about after break. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. In the studio with me, managing editor of the New Hampshire Union Leader, Matt Sartwell, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. We learned this week that Mary Stuart Guile has passed away after a battle with cancer. She was 83 years old. She is being remembered as a lawmaker with a lot of heart, and one of her signature issues was the fight for paid family and medical leave. Here she is in her own words.
Basic leave for employees across the nation is long overdue. The United States is way behind in its policies to support working families.
That's Mary Stuart Guile. Dean, your thoughts on Mary Stuart Guile, her work and her legacy.
Yeah, absolutely. She was particularly well-known in the Concord area. You often heard people talking about her bipartisan approach to legislating. She was first elected to the state legislature in 1995 and finally retired in 2018. And as you mentioned, she was on this 20-plus year quest for family medical leave. At the state level, the Democrats almost got there. They passed the legislation. It was vetoed by Governor Sununu. And I think regardless of who the Democratic nominee is for governor in 2020, it's going to be a central, I think, issue in the campaign, whether or not the state will have that in place. There's been debate between Sununu and the Democrats about over how you fund it. Even though there's some general agreement that it would be a good idea. So this was one of her key issues for several decades. And her background was in education. She worked for a while in the Department of Education. So she also did a lot to reform early childhood education and child care credentialing, things like that. But she's just being remembered, again, as I said, particularly in the Concord area, someone who's very concerned about child welfare, education, family issues, this Family Medical Leave Act. Was really kind of her last big focus, and I think she'll be missed by politicos in the Capital Region.
Democrat Mary Stuart Guile passed away this week at the age of 83. Also in the news this week, police in New Hampshire are calling for more resources to support officers who are struggling with mental health issues. Dean, what prompted this call?
The proximate cause of this appears to be the death of Captain John Lido, who was a national police officer since 1999, and the police with Gene Shaheen getting involved have had a roundtable discussion. The issue is that the suicide among police officers nationwide is apparently a bigger issue than maybe people realize, given the stresses of the job and the impact it can have on families. And so talking about the captain's death, but also kind of looking more broadly at issues of mental health in the police force, which is maybe not something you typically hear a lot about. There's this roundtable discussion, and Gene Shaheen participated, called for more resources for law enforcement focused on mental health, things like counseling and resiliency, to a fuller consideration of some of the health issues, much in the same way, in some sense, we talk about the military, PTSD, things like that. You can have some of those same issues being replicated in the local law enforcement community.
So when they say resources, I assume they mean money. Yeah,
typically money, right? The ability to put in place these structures, fund counselors, things like that.
Matt?
Yeah, this is just a terribly heartbreaking story. And I gotta give a tip of the hat to Nashville Police Chief Michael Carignan. I mean, this happened with him only a couple months on the job, and this terrible tragedy rocks his department. And he's with our reporter Kim Houghton. He was very forthcoming, saying, "Listen, I'm gonna tell you what I can, when I can." And when he could tell, when he got it clear from the family, he really opened up and said, "Listen, this is a problem, and that I want my officers not to suffer in silence." I mean, we often as Dean pointed out, these first responders, they have just such a tremendous, tremendous job. I mean, often in the news business, people migrate to, stories about police doing this or that because, people read them. But my goodness, the job that the police do around the state is amazing. And we should all take a little time just to, understand that it's just an incredible, tough job.
Matt, maybe Dean, you can weigh in on this, too. Like, what do we know about the programs, police departments, but also, EMTs, firefighters already have in place to sort of help people who encounter the worst possible things out there to decompress and figure out what's happening with what they're seeing? Do you know of any of those programs? Do they have programs to help?
I don't. I mean, the fact that we're not really sure what the extent of the resources are, I think, is indicative of the problem. And I'm sure there are probably some connections to counseling, but I don't know if there are particular organizations that may deal with that. But I think that's part of the issue.
Yeah, I mean, I think the police agencies are so different in scale throughout the state, and there's no centralized sort of.
It's going to vary widely.
It's going to vary. But we did the union leader in our headliner series did a really interesting talk with Ken Norton on our Footprints in the Snow, where we talked to a woman who had rescued a man. Rescued a man who was thinking about committing suicide in the White Mountains. And Ken Norton said one of the things that could really help out was getting, I think it's just a simplified number for people to call for suicide prevention or to help. And I think NHPR has done some stories like that. I think it's 988. I think that's what it is, or 998. Anyways, that's what they're trying to get past.
Well, worth mentioning here that we do have the National Suicide Prevention Line here. It is, pardon me, 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-8255. There's also help here in the state of New Hampshire on the New Hampshire National Alliance on Mental Illness website. That's the NAMI website for anyone who might be in crisis. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. Other stories that we've been following in the news this week have to do with the unemployment rate for the month of September held flat at 2.5%. The state added 850 jobs, saw its labor force grow by another 1,000 people last month. That's according to new government figures. New Hampshire has one of the lowest unemployment rates in the nation, and the U.S. rate stands at 3.5%. The Attorney General's office says Littleton Regional Hospital can withdraw from an affiliation with other North Country hospitals if it meets certain conditions. It must pay a fee of at least $2.5 million and, among other things, support a home health and hospice agency and serve as the regional hub for substance use disorder services. The North Country Healthcare Collaborative was created in 2015, but Littleton Regional pulled out in April. And finally, the director of the Maine Center for Disease Control and Prevention says it could be a tough flu season. The season lasts from October to May and typically peaks in the winter months. Maine CDC director says the severity of the flu season in Australia could indicate that the U.S. is headed for a higher number of cases this time around. Want to make mention of a listener comment from our earlier conversation on homelessness and opioids. Dick wrote in to say, "I take issue with the statement that wherever there is an opiate problem, there is a corresponding homelessness problem," implying that opiate use is the cause of homelessness. The challenge of homelessness can be a result of many factors and is often a result of the cycle of poverty, job loss, abuse by a spouse or partner, etc., and not necessarily opiate use and addiction. I think he's referring to something you said, Matt, but I don't know if I didn't take from your comments, Matt, that you meant correlation is causation.
No, but that wasn't what I was getting at, but I agree with his point. All those, there are so many different factors, you know, that go into homelessness, and let's face it, that's one of the reasons why it's persistent.
Mm-hmm. Dean, I wanted to ask you about one of these stories that we've covered here on NHPR this week. The New Hampshire Supreme Court heard arguments on Wednesday in the case State versus Christina A. Hill. This case had to do with interpreting the recently passed bail reform law. Are you familiar with this, Dean?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is the issue with bail reform, and we've had some pushback recently. I mean, Matt can certainly jump in, but we've had some pushback from the police that the bail reform, which is a way to avoid having people being held in jail for long periods of time because they can't make their bail, this is in practice has become problematic, and so I think that this is now being challenged in the court.
Matt, thoughts?
You know, one of the things that we've been trying to get a hold of is speak to bail commissioners, the people that are private contractors that the different agencies have that they bring in. And these guys are paid kind of per person that they discuss bail with, which is really interesting. And we can't quite find somebody who's the overarching supervising agency, although we're still looking into it.
So bail commissioner, what exactly is their role in this?
They actually, for a lot of cases, it's not a judge. It's a bail commissioner who actually decides who's getting bail. That's my understanding. We're still trying to get a handle on it.
Oh, wow. Okay, bail commissioner is still something that journalists really want to talk to right now.
Yeah.
And one of the problems, as I understand it, and as NHPR's Mary McIntyre pointed out last week, that, this is it's a problem in part because there's no statewide database to help us figure out how big a problem the one police are describing is. The problem is that, in their view, people are being rearrested because they're not being held on bail. They're being let go on personal recognizance, committing crimes again, becoming a nuisance
right.
for police. We don't quite know yet exactly how pervasive a problem it is. This is a story, I think, that we're going to continue to follow here at NHPR. I imagine the union leader is going to stay on top of this as well.
There might be a bail commission story coming.
There might be. Stay tuned. Well, Matt, as we wrap up the show, I want to hear exactly what stories you or your team will be really looking forward to in the coming week. What do you think?
Well, we're definitely going to follow the Dale Holloway story. We'll be working on, we're taking another look at Real ID this weekend in the Sunday News. And we're also going to take a look at the changes of Fish and Game that just happened last week, too.
Lots to read about in the Union Leader. Okay. And Dean, what will you be following next week?
Looking to see, you know, along the lines of what Paul mentioned in the first part of the show, coming out of this last presidential debate, you have a couple of mid-tier candidates, Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, Cory Booker. They had good nights. They're now in the process of trying to translate that into more momentum on the ground here in New Hampshire. So a number of them are in and around New Hampshire over the next week or so, plus the front runners, to see if they can capitalize on their performances.
All right. Dean Spiliota, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Matt Sartwell, managing editor for the New Hampshire Union Leader. Thank you both very much for being here for the full hour today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks,
great.
Peter.
Thanks also to NHPR's Jason Moon and political reporter Paul Steinhauser for joining us earlier in the program. For links to all of the stories that we have discussed today, check out our website, nhpr.org, which is where the conversation continues. You can also keep it going on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brindley is our program manager, and our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.